County cricket, international cricket, test cricket, franchise cricket, red ball, white ball, 100 ball cricket. At The Cricketer, we care about the cricket you love. And that's why this December, we're launching a brand new app built for fans of the English game. Download The Cricketer app and sign up to our Access All Areas Pass to receive agenda-setting journalism and illuminating storytelling straight to your phone. The latest news from the England camps, a dedicated daily service for fans of the 18 first-class counties, and committed coverage of women's cricket. Download the app today and enjoy 1 month of free unlimited access. The Cricketer. We care about the cricket you love.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the County Cricket Podcast in association with our friends at Bear Cricket. I'm your host, Aaron, aka The Cricket Connoisseur, and on my left for today's special episode of the County Cricket Podcast is none other than Worcestershire County Cricket Club's assistant head coach, Alan Richardson. So, Alan, first things first, it's an absolute pleasure to get you on the podcast today for a chat about all things county cricket. I have to ask, mate, how's your day been so far?
Pretty quiet so far. We've just started back training for the boys, and we do four pretty hard days for them, try and almost replicate a four-day thing. And then we have Friday where they do their personal development stuff and we get a chance to catch up on our work and have a few meetings. So it's been pretty quiet today, which has been it's quite nice really leading into the weekend.
Yeah, exactly. It is nice. But with that being said, it's good to see the players back, isn't it, as well? We are getting to the point of the season where we've got, you know, winter training back on. We're getting ready, I suppose, the first tentative steps towards the 2022 county cricket season. And to be honest, I can't wait. I cannot wait. Just to think that the 2021 season finished last month on the 1st of October, Warwickshire winning the Bob Willis Trophy. It's felt like a year. It really has. I just want county cricket to come back. I'm not sure if that's just me. I know it's different for the players and the coaches who have gone through the county grind all season long, but my goodness, the off-season, it does drag on. It does drag on. The only good thing, I suppose, though, is we have got the Ashes. And Alan, before we go into today's podcast and the content, I have to ask, are you feeling confident of us pulling off a result down under?
Yeah, 5-0. Quite comfortably, I would have thought. I think it'll be really competitive. I think the obvious thing for me would be that Ben Stokes is now available. Who knows what sort of, cricketing state he's going to be in. He's been out for a little while. But, you know, he's so competitive. He's such a leader in that group. And he, for me, it just adds such balance. I think that's been, you know, you don't want to pin it on one player. But when he's not playing, that balance is really, I guess, compromised in terms of, you know, trying to fit five bowlers in, or do you just go in with four bowlers? And what does that attack then look like? So I think it just opens it up and just makes us a stronger team, not only obviously because of his ability, but because then it just gives us that opportunities with the balance of the side. So I think hopefully it'll be a really competitive series. And no doubt if we'd have won the T20 World Cup, we'd have said we had huge momentum, but as it turns out that it's, you know, it's not quite worked that way. But I think, you know, I look at it and I hope that it's going to be really competitive, and I expect it to be. And it would be great if it went down into the last test match, I guess.
It most certainly would. Obviously, with England 4-0 up at that point, that would be fantastic as well from a very, very biased English perspective. But as you said, I could not agree more. I think it's going to be a really compelling series. England, it's a massive, massive morale boost to have Ben Stokes back. We saw during this summer, didn't we, the supposed lack of balance with regards to that batting lineup. Ben Stokes adds so much stability, and he also provides some breakthroughs with the ball. I think back to the 2020 series against South Africa, that incredible game at Newlands, when he was bowling at the end of that test match tirelessly, absolutely indefatigable towards the end, getting those wickets. We had that final last catch, didn't we, from Zach Crawley in the slips as well. So Ben Stokes, that is going to be massive. And of course, I think it goes without saying, but we are wishing the England boys nothing but the very best of luck heading into the Ashes come the 8th of December. But in terms of today's podcast, Alan, we aren't really going to be talking so much about the Ashes. Instead, we're going to be talking about your cricket career to date. And I suppose there's only one place that we can start, and that is with the origin of the Alan Richardson cricketing journey. So, Richo, what are your first ever memories of cricket, either playing or watching this wonderful game?
I think I'd have started very similar to a lot of people who've played a lot of cricket, and that my dad played poorly, but he played, and he was the my local cricket club. He was the third 11 captain for a little while. And so my mum worked over weekends. I've got my sister's quite a bit older. She's 10 years older. So she would start to do Saturday jobs and things like that. So suddenly it was like I had no option as a 5-6 year old to go and actually go with my dad for the day on a Saturday in the summer. And I just remember going and absolutely loving it. You know, I think from what I've been told from a really young age, I just loved sport. I loved, you know, throwing a ball around, kicking a ball, you know, just general stuff like that. So to be given that opportunity where just with my dad and just watching a game of cricket and then getting guys to bowl at me or for me to bowl at them, you know, I was there for 7-8 hours as you would be in a great environment with other kids there and just running around and just grew up in that club environment, really, which is a huge part for me. I absolutely love it in terms of that. It was such a big part of my career, but also my life as well. You know, you grow up and you learn some really good social skills. You get to hang around with people that you wouldn't normally because you're at school and, you know, suddenly on a Saturday you're meeting new people and you're just experiencing lots of different things. And so for me, that's where it all started, really. And then I was hooked, really. Would watch it a lot on telly, despite, I guess, not much being on. And then I went to my first ever game when I was 10. I went to Edgbaston. So we're originally from Staffordshire. So and watched the test match there in the 1985 Ashes. I think Tim Robinson got runs, David Gower got runs, Ian Botham slogged a few at the end. Jeff Thompson gave a certain salute to the Hollies. And I was just hooked from that day. It was a Saturday. It was really hot. I just remember just sitting on the benches and absolutely loving it. So, yeah, I think I was just a typical boy, really, in terms of loving my sport and then just got into it because my dad was there and I had no other option, really.
Well, Alan, I must admit, that is a lovely journey into the game. It really is that family, that community element of the game really coming to the forefront in your earliest days and a fantastic first choice of test match and a brilliant venue, of course, here. In the West Midlands at Edgbaston Cricket Ground. And you mentioned some massive names there, the likes of David Gower, Ian Botham, Jeff Thompson as well, him and Dennis Lilly, my goodness, those two really were a maelstrom when they were bowling together for the Aussies. But in terms of that wider professional cricketing world, were they your idols or did you have any other role models, any other icons that you tried to emulate in those formative years per se?
I think just fairly typical because there wasn't much, the cricket was on, but there was certainly nowhere near the volume now. Like Ian Botham would have certainly just been someone that I would have watched from a young age and have absolutely loved that. I remember, so this will really disappoint you, but being like this cricket tragic that I was, I'd read lots of books as well as a child and I'd look through and not really struck a chord with me because they had Clive Rice and Richard Hadley. Who two amazing cricketers. So they were two people that I really followed and really enjoyed and watching Richard Hadley whenever he was over in England and the way that he bowled and just listening to his stories and how he went about it. So Richard Hadley would have definitely been one of those ones, which is slightly obscure, I guess, because I wouldn't have seen that much of him. I certainly barely saw him live, but I'd just be relying on sketchy videos or whatever, or whenever New Zealand travelled to England, which wouldn't have been that often. So for him, going forward, then it was someone who's really not, I guess, someone who you would say, this is going to be my hero, because he made bowling look really hard, but it really related to me. And that was Angus Fraser. Just remember, he burst on the scene. So when I was in my teenage years and working out that, right, well, I definitely can't bat, but I can bowl. I'm okay at bowling. That's okay. And I'm watching it, but it was hard. I felt like it was hard work. My body would be sore and I'd be stiff. And then I'd watch Angus Fraser, who made it look incredibly difficult. And he looked incredibly miserable. And I was like, I really enjoy it. The way he went about it, there was nothing spectacular about Gus's bowling, except that he was incredibly accurate. He did a little bit with the ball, but he wasn't particularly quick, got it to bounce a little bit. But he just came into a side, England as well, which was not particularly doing very well. And we get stuffed by the Aussies a lot. But he you know, stood out for me. So, and I was very lucky later on in my time when I was at Middlesex at Gus. Ended up being director of cricket for a while, so I got to spend a couple of years with him and absolutely loved my time. But yeah, it's very unfashionable, but I guess, you know, going away from the Bothams and Hadleys, it was Gus Fraser, really. You know, I sort of kind of modelled my mantra on him. You know, it was like, if I don't go for any runs, then I won't get taken off, so then I can just keep bowling a bit more. And I actually love bowling and I can't bat and fielding's not great. So that would have been my one. So yeah, looking at it, Now, you didn't get as much cricket as you do now on telly, so I'd be hooked every test match, every one day international. I'd be hooked watching it on telly. And then, yeah, watching Gus, I was like, he makes it look hard work. I like this.
Well, I'll tell you what, I think that's quite a nice choice. It's not often that we get Angus Fraser actually brought up as an idol or a role model. We usually talk about Gus as Mr. Middlesex because that's what he is. Okay, he lives and breathes the Saxes. He is such an integral member of that club, and everyone loves Gus Fraser. Great, great character as well, and was a fantastic cricketer in the 1990s. And Alan, we have brought up bowling, and I suppose before we talk about your county career, we have to talk about one aspect of your bowling, and that is the action. Quote unquote, the windmill, okay? So I have to ask this about your bowling style. Have you always had that bowling action, or was that something which, I don't know, you acquired over the years? What is the story behind the windmill?
So, you know, growing up and being in, I guess, the generation that was, I had no idea that I had a windmill until I was about 16, 17, and I got videoed for the first time. So I had no idea, and no one had really mentioned it to me. We go back, watch my dad. My dad was just a bits and pieces cricketer, you know, but he bowled some filthy off-cuttery things. But he had a windmill. And I can only presume that I would have just watched my dad and, you know, in the garden when he would have bowled at me and then watching him in games and just picked it up. And it just felt the most natural thing in the world. I had no idea that it was so unorthodox that there was arms and legs going everywhere. And like I said, it was only probably about the age, and it sounds ridiculous, but no one ever really mentioned it to me. They just would talk about the outcome, and you're like, well, you know, I was okay, but I wasn't getting any of the county sides when I was younger, but I was playing a decent standard of club cricket and doing okay. And people would just talk about, you know, well, you're doing all right, you're getting some wickets, you know. Well, no one had ever talked to me about action or my technique. So it was really, really strange to then suddenly watch myself at 16 and 17 and go, that can't be me. That's ridiculous. There's like this huge windmill thing. Well, what the hell is that? And then from then on, really just really tried to embrace it. And then I think throughout my career after that, the understanding of it was the thing that intrigued me the most, really. So yeah, it certainly helped me in my career. I think there were certain batters who really struggled with it. Then it was like, whoa, what is going on here? Which hand's that come out of? When's the timing of that? And so I had to use it as a strength more than anything. And I had to really embrace it and be happy with it. I changed it once in 2004. And it was a huge regret of mine. I actually got released from Warwickshire at the end of that season, having the worst season. But I got to a stage where I was like, I'm not doing what I want to do. I'm going to change my action. And I lost the windmill for a while. And it was a ridiculous, ridiculous idea. It was completely driven by me. And it lasted about 2 months and then went back.
Well, that's a common theme, isn't it? We see that a lot with batting techniques as well. Obviously, quite recently with the likes of Dom Sibley, Rory Burns as well. It's people wanting to tinker and change. And sometimes when it is a natural action or a natural batting technique or a natural bowling action, you just need to stay with it because it's got you up until that point. Yes, you can make little iterations here and there, little changes now and again, little variances of that action, but you have to stick with what feels natural, with what's got you to that stage. And I have to actually ask this, Alan, because this is interesting when I always talk about seam bowling with seam bowlers. I have to ask this, what is, in your opinion, the most pivotal weapon of the seam bowler's arsenal? Is it speed? Is it seam movement? Is it swing? Is it accuracy, reliability, consistency? What do you think really makes the best seam bowlers in the game of cricket?
Okay, I will bore you with this now for a little while because this is a bit of my mantra, and I look at it, and whether they are seam bowlers or even spin bowlers, I'm like, you've got four attributes that you use. So in no particular order, we've got pace, we have bounce, we have movement, and we have control. And if you tick all four of those boxes, then, wow, you're going to be doing really well. So if you watch people at their best, and I think about Stuart Broad, when he has those spells, and he has them, and he's had them a lot over his time, certainly in international cricket, where he just blows through a side. You know, he does all four of those things amazingly well. So he bowls with good pace. So, you know, it's interesting when the higher the standard you go, what they consider pace, and you speak to some batters now, they're like 85 miles an hour is not pace. I'm like, that it feels quick to me. So pace, bounce, movement, which would be either off the pitch or in the air, But I think the only non-negotiable for me would be control, because actually you could have all the other three, but if you don't know where it's going and you have no point of reference, I think I'll only get you so far, and then eventually it will break down. So it's being able to bowl with control and really utilize those other three attributes as well as you can do. So can I keep control? How fast can I bowl and keep that control? What sort of movement am I getting? So where's my seam position, point of release, etc. And am I generating bounce? I might not be the tallest bowler in the world, but am I getting more bounce than what people think I'm going to get? That invariably comes from hitting the seam or having a bit of action on the ball or whatever. But it's, for me, the control is a non-negotiable. It's a bit boring and people get into a bit of a, I think, an old school, oh, you just don't want to dob it on a length. I'm not asking you to do that. But what I am saying is control, you have to have a point of reference. You have to know where the ball's going. You have to have that control, that mastery over where the ball is going. And then if we can add all the other three things to it, then I think, you know, that's where it comes from for me.
I would agree with that, because if you think about this, you could bowl a 95 mile an hour delivery. It could be an absolute jaffer, but it's no good if it's not hitting the cut strip, is it? If it's a 95 mile an hour Yorker, but you're not hitting your lines, you're not hitting the length, it's not going to make any difference. You have to have control. And that is the difference between lower level bowlers and the real elite bowlers. I mean, I'll just say myself as an example here. I'm a spin bowler. I'm a failed seamer. I don't have any embarrassment saying that at all, because I love the art of spin bowling now. But the difference between me and, let's say, a county spinner, obviously pace. Okay, I don't bowl it ridiculously quickly, but it's control. I can turn a cricket ball, but that doesn't mean that I can turn it on six separate occasions during an over and set up a batsman, as well as, let's say, a Dom Bescan or a Simon Harmer, to name just two spinners in county cricket right now off the top of my head. That is the difference. Control, I get what you mean. It's the one which is seen as maybe the boring one, the bland one, but it is the most important one. It's about having those fundamentals and building off of it. You need the groundwork to actually achieve good things in this game. So I think that's quite sagely advice, Percy Allen. I really, really do. And for any young bowlers, seam or spinners, again, just try and get accuracy. Try and improve your reliability, your consistency, hitting that penny on a length, shall we say. I mean, some people actually do that as a drill. Another one which I do like in county cricket, this is at Derbyshire now, and this will relate nicely onto your debut, actually, Alan, when we talk about that in a second. But Derbyshire, they have a drill called paying the bills. So they put a sticker on the off stump, and their seam bowlers have to hit that sticker on the stump. And that is how they get that muscle memory. That's how they train themselves to hit off stump with the red ball. I think it's fantastic. I think it's a fascinating drill. I really do. And I did just allude to it there, Derbyshire County Cricket Club, Alan. I don't think I could have, you know, set up a better segment than that to talk about your debut, to be completely honest, because that was for the East Midlands County. So after going through club cricket, after having that journey, you arrive at Derbyshire County Cricket Club. And I have to ask, what do you remember from your debut? What do you remember from walking out on that pitch as a player for Derbyshire County Cricket Club, one of the first-class counties in England and Wales?
Yeah, I think, well, my debut would have been in 95 against Oxford Uni at the Parks. Not much, really, if I'm honest. Felt very lucky. Felt like it was something that was never going to happen. If I'm going to be honest, I signed as an 18-year-old. I could not have been any further out of my depth. I was drowning on a daily basis, really. I hadn't played any representative cricket, any county cricket. There was no academies around until I was 17. So within a year, I was suddenly in a first-class squad. And I was so unbelievably raw, as you would expect an 18-year-old to be, but I'd got very little behind me. And so, yeah, I felt incredibly lucky. I really enjoyed it. I remember Oxford Uni had a pretty strong side then. And we won, but it was great. I remember driving down with Kim Barnett and driving back with Kim Barnett. It was a legend at Derby County Cricket Club. I was the captain at the time. And, yeah, I just remember really loving it and going, I want more of this, but I'm going to have to get so much better. I mean, I think I took a couple of wickets. They stuck me in at five in the second innings and I got caught mid-on trying to hook, which I couldn't even do. But just remembering, right, I'm loving this. This is amazing. But I've still got a long way to go. And remembering when I first walked into the Derby changing room in pre-season in 1994, the overseas was Ian Bishop. They had Devon Malcolm, Philip DeFratis, Simon Bass, Dominic Cork, Alan Warner, to name but a few, Paul Mortensen. They had these eight or nine quality seamers. And then there was me, and I was like, right, I've got plenty to do here. But it was an amazing experience, and I loved it, but I was not even close to being ready.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because after 1995, you went on to play for Staffordshire, one of the national counties here in England and Wales, actually your home county as well, which I think is quite nice. I have to ask, how would you describe your experiences with the national counties? I suppose back then they were known as a minor county, but we try our best not to call them that on the County Cricket Podcast, because, again, they are important and they are a very, very good feeder network, I think, to the first-class counties. How integral of an experience was that for you in terms of setting you on the right pathway to getting back into county cricket?
Incredibly important. I consider my 3 years at Staffordshire, where I played in club cricket as well, 2 years from my home club, and I moved for a year, were absolutely integral. Like I said before, at Derby, I couldn't have been any further out of my depth. I was drowning on a daily basis. And whilst I really enjoyed it, it was a real struggle. To then go and play minor counties cricket, and I don't mind calling it, and I'm sure no one else would, that it was amazing, because it was sort of that step. So it was obviously better than club cricket, but it wasn't as good as first-class cricket. And do you know what? A really good staff side would have given a second team a good game and probably would have won quite a few. So it was that real step where I could go and play cricket on a Saturday and a Sunday for my club, and then try and play as much for Staffordshire as I could, trialling around. And I had 3 years of doing that, which was absolutely integral. Played with some really good players, played against some really good players. So Laurie Potter was they still have a pro, someone who's allowed to get paid, who invariably would have played a lot of cricket. So Wayne Larkins was at Bedfordshire. Derek Randall was at Suffolk. This is probably showing how old I am, Aaron, so remember that as well. And you get a chance to play against these guys. And then I managed to get picked for the minor counties representative side, where we'd play touring teams and we'd play in the Benson Hedges. Now, we got absolutely slaughtered in those games, certainly in the Benson Hedges games. But it was such a great experience. So I was suddenly hanging around with guys who were either ex-pros who've been there and done it and even played test cricket, so I could pick their brains, or guys who were similar to me who were trying to make their way in the game, who probably had an opportunity to come back out and were trying to go again. So it was absolutely brilliant. And the level that I could play at was a real challenge for me still, but not so much so that I could not handle it, which is what I felt like happened to me a lot at Derby. And so it was amazing. And I love my time. We talk about it a lot. When I was at Warwickshire as a coach and at Worcester, I encourage as many guys as possible to go and play minor counties cricket when they get a chance, because I just hold it in such value. It was amazing for me to do. You play on lots of different surfaces against lots of good players, good club players who understand how to get wickets and score runs. So yeah, it was fantastic for me. I absolutely loved my time there. And thankfully in 98, Staffordshire won the whole thing. And it was, I got signed after that, but it was such a good year for me to have with them. And I just absolutely loved it. I got looked after brilliantly well. If it ever looked like I was getting too big for my boots, they slapped me down. And if it ever looked like I was struggling, they picked me up and kept me going. And it was just brilliant for me to be in that environment.
Well, Alan, that is lovely to hear. It really, really is, because I am an advocate for the national counties or the minor counties, whatever you want to call them. We all know what they are, basically. We're talking about the exact same thing. But I do think they are a really necessary building block for not just young cricketers, but also cricketers trying to get back into that first-class setup. Because I just think right now, as of 2021, Staffordshire are a fantastic, fantastic side for the likes of Worcestershire and Warwickshire. They are almost like a satellite county, aren't they, for Midlands clubs. Yeah. You think of Cornwall as well, down in the southwest, Oxfordshire as well, who have just signed a brand new, I think a 5-year deal actually, with Sussex as well, which is massive. It's absolutely massive. So they're such an integral part of the network. And this is a little bit off topic, but in the future, would you like to see them return to the One Day Cup in some shape or form? Because we've had cricketers on the podcast here who used to play for the minor counties. And they would play the likes of Warwickshire, they'd play the likes of Surrey, or they'd play the likes of Somerset. And they were really big occasions for young cricketers. Would you be in favour of them returning, or I don't know, another iteration of the unicorns, for anyone who remembers those from like the Pro 40 as well. Would you be in favour of the minor counties coming back into the foray, per se, in the 50-over cup at some point?
I think if possible, it would be great. I do think that. I think everyone, or the majority of counties, played a warm-up game against someone. So we played Herefordshire, who are one of our affiliated minor counties or national counties. So them and Shropshire are two counties who we take a lot of interest in. And we've been very lucky with Shropshire that we, you know, there's a lot of players that have come through Shropshire that we've, you know, had. So Joe Clark, Ed Barnard, Dylan Pennington, they're all Shropshire boys. They're all very, very good cricketers. Without Shropshire's help, and I'm missing out on probably several others, you know, it would be even harder for us. So it's amazing. And I think that opportunity to play that game, we played Herefordshire. It was a really good game to play in. I hope they enjoyed it. We certainly did. And we spent a bit of time with them afterwards. You know, we knew most of them, and some had been in and around our system quite a while. So it was Matt Pardo as their captain. It was just really good to be in and around. And I think if possible, it would be great. I understand the difficulties of it all, and I understand the logistics of it all, but I think it would be an amazing opportunity. It would give them a real chance to perform on a stage, and it would put the counties under pressure. I remember being part of that at Staffs, and we gave a couple of sides some decent games, and it certainly happened when I played for the Unicorns as well, that you give sides a bit of a scare every now and again, and you put them under pressure. And so I think it would be a great opportunity. I don't know how they're going to do it, but it would be amazing to be able to do it, even if it was just a knockout game, first round, which it used to be, you know, and some minor counties every now and again would get the shock and would win. And I think, I would like it, but I think it's going to prove harder and harder to be able to do.
It is. That's the problem. It's the logistics, because from a sentimental perspective, I would love to see it. I'd absolutely love to see the minor counties have a shot at the quote-unquote big boys, because you mentioned those warm-up games this summer. The Welsh minor counties beat Glamorgan at Sapphire Gardens, yes, who went on to win the trophy, which was staggering, by the way. A first trophy for Glamorgan since 2004. Absolutely delighted for the Welsh fans. And Cornwall beat Somerset at the Cooper Associates ground as well. So you never know, and that is the beauty of our sport. You can never really, unless it's like a test match and they're massively, you know, mismatched teams, you can never, ever with 100% certainty predict a result. And we do get upsets, we do get shocks. It's just food for thought. If we could find a way in the future to bring the national counties back in, even if it is with a unicorn side, and I understand there are some, you know, some issues with the unicorns from a financial aspect as well. They would need to actually play quite a few games in order for it to be economically viable. I completely understand that. But I would like to see the national counties back in some way, shape or form. So we keep our fingers crossed here at the County Cricket Podcast, and we'll have to wait and see if there are any developments heading into the near future. But Richo, getting back onto track, because again, I did just say we were deviating there. I just had to ask that question while we were talking about the national counties. But the next county that you played for is my county of Warwickshire. Now, this was after Warwickshire's, I suppose, the golden era of the mid-1990s, when we had the likes of Lara, Donald, Tim Munton, Reeve, so many fantastic, fantastic players played for Warwickshire during the early to mid-90s. I have to ask, what were your first impressions of Warwickshire County Cricket Club?
Wow, it's big. it's a machine. It's I signed at the end of 98, so I was far, far more ready for it, I guess. I was far more prepared. I was a far different player by then. I was a bit more confident in my own ability. But yeah, just walking in, and you know, I managed to play some trial games, and Tim Munton was playing, and Gladstone Small was playing, and Dominic Osler and Keith Piper, and you're like, wow, okay, this is very different. And it was, you know, I caught that the end of the 90s, which was a real transition period for them. They'd had such a strong side throughout the 90s, such influential characters, such big players, that I just caught that the end of that. So Dermot had finished by then, Asif Din had finished by then, Roger Tews had left by then, that was Moeller's last year. So some huge, huge characters. And so just to watch that again, you know, it was just big. It was, you know, Dennis was the chief exec. It was just a huge machine. I mean, it's even bigger now. You know, I live really close to it now, and you go past the stadium now and there's all sorts going on there. You're like, this is huge. This is such a big county. it very much felt like that still, and as it should do, really. It's, you know, it's one of the biggest counties in the country. So thankfully, I was far more prepared for this opportunity. If I'd have done that during my Derby days, I would have got swallowed up within a couple of days, I think. But yeah, it was huge.
Yeah, and we still are to this day. We certainly are the county champions in 2021. My goodness, how good does that sound, to say the least? But we are a big club. And again, it does mean a lot to us here in Warwickshire, in particular, because they are the only professional team that we have sporting-wise in Shakespeare's County. So it's a massive honour, a massive privilege. And as I said, that club really does mean the world to us. So it's always a massive thing to play for Warwickshire County Cricket Club. It really is, in particular, if you are from the Midlands. It's absolutely massive. It's an honour and a privilege to play for such an illustrious county. And I have to ask, in retrospect, Alan, what do you say was your highlight from your time with the Bears? Because our county did win a certain big trophy, shall we say, under the leadership of Nick Knight.
I would say personally, for a highlight for me, so I think my time at Warwickshire was a real roller coaster in the end for me. It was my opportunity again, and I will forever be in their debt. And I absolutely loved my time there. To play with the guys that I played with, and to have the opportunities to be at the county was amazing. So for me, a personal highlight, I got capped, which was a huge thing. I remember walking in on those first days in pre-season, and you go in the away changing room as an uncapped player, and the capped players had a club car, they had a locker. I was like, I really want a club car, and I really want a locker. How am I going to do that? So start asking questions and do that. So to get the cap, so take away the car and the locker and the things, to be recognised as someone who's had an input at the club was amazing, really. So that for me, during my time, we won the Benson and Hedges as well, and I played all the way through until the semi-final where I got injured, and Neil Carter took my place, and he performed brilliantly in the semi-final and played in the final as well. But in 2004, my last year, they won the county championship. And it was a huge regret of mine now. I look at it, and my nine wickets at 60 didn't really contribute much to the championship win in 2004. And I sort of fell out of the reckoning and really struggled with that, having played quite a lot of cricket for 3 or 4 years for the first team. And so I sort of became isolated from that. And I actually wasn't there at Northampton when they actually won it and they lifted the trophy. And that was a huge regret that I wasn't there for that. And so I look back on that, you know, I'm a county championship winner. I didn't contribute massive in that year, but I certainly contributed up until that. And I thought I was part of, you know, that transition from going where the great side of the 90s were now starting to go again, and hopefully, you know, perform. Probably weren't going to match what Dermot and Bob's side did, but to try and become successful and give the members, you know, the success that they crave and the players. So I think 2004, I hold it really closely to me that I was a county championship winner, but I became very isolated. That was mainly down to me, really, because I really struggled with it and I ended up leaving at the end of that year. So I think for me, the personal highlight would have been my county cap and being recognised as one of those players that I was trusted to be a senior player and carry on the legacy of so many other players.
Absolutely. It's always a very, very special moment, that, isn't it? Receiving your cap. We spoke with Charles Dagnall about this as well, and he said he almost welled up. It was a massive, massive moment, because it is that recognition that you've produced so many fantastic moments for the club. As you said, you get all the benefits as well associated with being a cap player. Again, it's a massive, massive honour and a privilege. And before we talk about your time with Middlesex and Worcestershire, I do actually just have a question here from Spencer Clark. And I think you'll know exactly which partnership this is referring to. But this is from Spencer. And he said, how tired were you after that 10th wicket partnership with Nick Knight?
That's my highest score, for anyone who doesn't know. I got 91. That's my highest score in any cricket. Junior cricket, Sunday friendlies. I truly was and still am a dreadful batter. And it came as a huge surprise to everyone that would know me, including myself. And I think I was absolutely shattered. I remember I got out, I think just before tea, and we went out and bowled, and I couldn't move my forearms. It was ridiculous. I'd never held a bat for that length of time before. I had no idea what I was doing. And so, yeah, I was absolutely shattered, if I'm honest. And I think more so the physical side of it all was quite bad. But mentally, again, I'd never had to concentrate for that period of time before. Not even been close, I don't think. I barely scored a 50. I might have scored a second team 50 somewhere along the line. So, yeah, just to have that. I got really lucky. I think I went out to bat the night before, and me and Knighty had refused singles and things so he could face more of the bowling. We got a bit of stick from the members, probably quite rightly, but we somehow managed to get through that night, 9 down. And Dimi Mascarenhas got injured right at the end of the day, so his hamstring had gone down. So their attack was a very young Chris Tremlett, Alan Mullally, Sean Udell and Neil Johnson from Zimbabwe. And I think they all would have got absolutely smashed in Broad Street that night, thinking we just needed one wicket. And they all turned up very hungover, as was a general, that is, you know, it wasn't unusual in those days. And me and Knighty, as we walked out, was like, how do you want to play this? She went, I just take strike again. And I was like, well, should we just see how we get on? And we just sort of wheeled our way through that first hour and they just wilted. And it was just, we just cracked on from there, really. Knighty was amazing. He was one of my favourite guys to play cricket with. He's had such an impact on the game whenever I played and worked out whatever format he needed to play. I ended up batting for about 4 hours, which again is ridiculous, and scored 91. I only scored 120 runs all year, I think. So I got about 75% in one game.
Yeah, definitely helped the average as well, didn't it? Scoring a 91, career best, as you said.
I reckon I still only averaged about 11 that year.
Even as a result
probably
of that.
Even as a result of that. So you can imagine what it was like. And I ended up getting out. I got stumped trying to slog sweep Giles White. So at this stage, they'd gone completely and they were just all sorts of part-timers were bowling at me. And we got a short leg side boundary and I was just like, I can do this in 2 hits. I've never been here. I'm well ahead of where I should be. I'm just going to 2 hits and I'll be done. I have no idea how I'm going to celebrate. I remember thinking I needed to change my gloves at about 60, but the issue, I hadn't got any spare gloves. I only got one pair of gloves as it was. I only got one bat. And so I couldn't even do that. So yeah, just dragged out and got stumped.
In hindsight, this is going to be a tough question. Before we talk about Middlesex and Worcestershire and the coaching aspects, in hindsight, do you wish you would have approached it slightly differently? In terms of those final 9 runs?
Yeah. Why I just didn't nerdle it around for another 10 minutes, 20 minutes, I would have got there and would have had a first-class 100 to my name. And you know, the chances of me replicating that were very slim. So, yeah, huge regret. Got well ahead of myself. Probably, I think I had a dodgy period in the 60s where I got dropped in the covers a couple of times where I got ahead of myself. And 90 dragged me back in and I think I'd lost my concentration again. And it was like, I'm in the 90s. I've got a part-time leg spin, a short leg side boundary. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, I'll tell you what, either way, a fantastic knock. It really was. And just to give some context behind that knock, a 214-run 10th wicket partnership. It's the highest last wicket partnership in Warwickshire's history in the county championship. And that is also, to date, the highest score by a Warwickshire number 11. So that is a record that you hold to this day, Alan Richardson. So well done for that. Obviously, 3 figures would have been fantastic. Of course, it would have been a bit like Jeetan Patel did in his first ever season. I think batting at 10, I think he was, Jeets, back in 2009. But my goodness, what a knock. What a player as well, Nick Knight. Great captain, wonderful broadcaster as well in the years that followed. And yeah, yet another fantastic piece of Bears history and another trophy to add to the collection here in the Midlands.
That record as an individual should be safe for a little while, as long as Ollie Haddon-Dowby's batting 11, I reckon. So I should be fine. I should be safe for a couple more years.
You say that, I must admit, this was actually the first game back this season, for fans that is, that we're allowed back into Edgbaston, Nottinghamshire. And I'll never, ever forget this partnership between Liam Norwell and Oliver Haddon-Dowby, a.k.a. the Ginger Jai Wardener and the Lanky Sangakkara. Ollie Haddon-Dowby... We needed one run. We were on 349 for 9. We needed one run, and it was in the final over to get the batting bonus point. And Ollie Haddon-Dowby, I kid you not, I've never, ever seen him play a shot like this. I don't think he played another shot like this all season. But he caressed one through the covers like he was Kumar Sangakkara. It was an absolutely ludicrous shot. For those who haven't watched Olihan and Dolby bat, trust me, it's a piece of majesty. It really is. It's one of nature's great wonders, watching the owl batting left-handed, even though he's a righty, and somehow just trying to survive. But that was a brilliant moment. And who knows? Who knows? The owl might be working on his batting, Alan, so we'll have to wait and see. But I think for the moment...
No, I'm safe. I'm fairly confident I'm safe for a little while. There's a challenge for him.
Yeah, get 92. There you go, Ollie. The glove has been laid down. The gauntlet has been laid, to say the least, for the 2022 season. But Alan, Warwickshire side, because you did leave the club at the end of that season in 2004 and you went to Middlesex. So just before we talk about Worcestershire, and we do have to talk quite a bit about the pairs, because your last seasons in particular with the West Midlands County were fantastic. They really were. But before we talk about that, the Saxes. Again, I have to ask, in retrospect, what were your highlights? What were your favourite moments from your time with the London-based club?
The most obvious one is the chance to play at Lords and to call Lords my home. I think it's safe to say, I don't think we'll get much argument, we massively underachieved for the personnel that we had. Like, the side that I walked into was phenomenal. I had Andrew Strauss, Ed Smith, Jamie Dalrymple, Ed Joyce, Owe Shaw, the sort of a top five, top six, Ben Scott or David Nash keeping wicket. And then after my first year, it was Chris Silverwood, Tim Murta, myself, Richard Johnson was there. Like, so whatever overseas you added, which was Murali Kartik for a while, I'm like, that should do okay. And we ended up playing a lot of our cricket in Division Two, which was unbelievably disappointing. So again, I got capped by Middlesex, and I take great, you know, huge, it's such a huge honour, and I'm so proud of the fact that, again, I was considered to be someone who would follow in some great names, really. And I know we won the T20. I had no part in that, which was amazing. We went on and played at Stamford in the Stamford Circus, which might be my personal highlight, actually. A chance to go to Antigua, and me, Silvers and Nashie were basically cheerleaders for the boys out there. But, yeah, it was that opportunity to play at Lords, the opportunity to play with some really good players, some great characters. Everyone at Middlesex was great. The whole committee were unbelievably supportive. Again, you know, worked under Gus for a little while as well. So it was that, really. You know, I had 5 years there, loved it in London, loved calling Lords my home, and just had such a good time, really. And after 2004, when I had a really poor season and really struggled, it was amazing to just get that fresh start, really. I never planned on leaving Warwickshire, never really wanted to, but it got to a stage where, you know, I sat with Nick Knight and John Inverarity, and they were great. And I absolutely loved playing for Warwickshire, and I loved playing for those guys. John would be one of my favourite coaches I ever dealt with. He was amazing. And they were just like, you might not play much next year, so if you want to leave, we're not going to get stand in your way. I'd still got a year left on my contract. So to make that move and to have that opportunity to go to Middlesex eventually ended up being too good to be true, really. But absolutely loved it out there. I made so many good friends through that, and friends that, you know, I still contact a lot and still talk a lot. So whenever I get a chance to go down to London and hopefully play at Lords a couple of times and coach there, it's great to catch up with everyone.
Well, that brings me on nicely to one of the, I suppose it is, it's still a county cricket related one, but it's not a club related question, this one. But I have to ask this on the podcast, because you did play in county cricket for a number of years, right? And this will be split into two parts, actually. But I want to know your favourite grounds, Alan. And obviously you can say New Road now. I completely understand if you want to do that, considering you are now the assistant head coach with the Rapids. But in terms of county cricket, what would you say is your favourite main ground and your favourite out ground in the county circuit that you've ever played at?
I'll start with my favourite outground, which would be Cheltenham.
Great shout.
Absolutely love it. Bit of a bowler's graveyard every now and again. So I didn't always have a great deal of success, but I just think for me, it was amazing. So when I was at Worcester, whenever we played Gloucester in the Championship, it was always at Cheltenham. It was always part of their Cheltenham Festival. I would stay down there because I was living in Birmingham, so it's too far. I'd just have a great week. The wicket was always a real good wicket. If you bowled well on it, you'd get your rewards. If you bowled poorly, you would go the absolute journey. We had some really good games of cricket there. And just the whole, I guess, the feel of it, it was so good, really. They do a really good job of it. And Cheltenham's a beautiful place to be anyway. So, yeah, Cheltenham without a shadow of a doubt for that one. And then I've got a top three. And then the most obvious top three is because that's where I played. And Derby is not one of them. So any Derbyshire fans, don't take offence. But I'd be... Lords was obviously fantastic. And it just is. The novelty for me will never, ever wear off. It didn't in my 5 years there where I was literally there. You know, you were there every other week. And it still will not now. Edgbaston, just purely because of the atmosphere. It has the best... For me, it has the best atmosphere. You know, you'll go to the other ones and they'll be slightly different. Headingley, Old Trafford, Surrey, when you've got T20 games, full house. But Edgbaston, for me, is the rightful home of the T20 finals day because it's such a good day. I've been very lucky to be part of a few of those as a coach. And so that's amazing. And then just because of the feel of it, and it is a beautiful ground, New Road would be right up there for me. I always felt that before I played there. And I always enjoyed being there, especially with the... It sounds a bit daft, but the old pavilion, like it couldn't have got any more English. It was just amazing. And we got the cathedral in the background. It had that lovely little hum around it. You know, everyone was so friendly. The members were so, so good to be around. They always are. They're very forgiving of some of the, certainly when I played there, some of the tosh that I would have delivered every now and again and as a team. Just such a good place, just such a good place to be. So those three, they're very unoriginal. So they're my three grounds. But they're the ones for me. And I was very lucky that I got to call them home.
Oh, absolutely. I must admit, I also will make that four nice choices. I love Cheltenham. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I went there in 2019 for a T20 match, Middlesex versus Gloucestershire. And it was brilliant. And the people down there are so friendly as well. I always big up the Gloucestershire members down in Cheltenham. So knowledgeable about the game, so kind as well. It's just a brilliant experience. I say this pretty much every time it comes up on the podcast, but if you haven't been to the Cheltenham Cricket Festival, I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's absolutely fantastic. When the weather's nice, the ground looks beautiful as well, with the college in the background. The wicket, as you said, really does make for some compelling cricket as well. Honestly, could not recommend that enough. And again, I am the resident Warwickshire fan here on the Counts Cricket Podcast, but let me just give credit where credit is due. New Road is a gorgeous ground. It really is, in particular for County Championship cricket. When the weather's nice and you've got that beautiful, beautiful cathedral in the background, it's a really nice open ground. And we do have our banter. We do have the Bears versus Pears. I call it a rivalry, but let's be honest. One team is a lot larger than the other. It's like the big brother and the little brother. But in terms of the actual ground itself and the club, I must admit, they are a nicely run club. So I'm not going to say big up to Worcestershire because I can't say that. The inner Warwickshire fan is telling me to be quiet right this instant. But it's so picturesque. It's so scenic, along with Taunton as well. Really, really nice grounds to watch some County Championship cricket at. And talking of New Road, Alan, before we get into your coaching days and we come to the concluding part of today's podcast, we have to talk about your time with Worcestershire, in particular in the County Championship. But before we get into that, how did that move transpire in the first place?
Yeah, so like I say, I was living my time down at Middlesex. I'd had a frustrating last year there. And my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, she's from Nottingham. So we were, you know, commuting, we were spending some time together and we had a chat. And it very much came down to a lifestyle decision that I wanted to move back to the Midlands. I'd still got a house in Birmingham. And so my contract was about to run out at Middlesex, so it was an opportunity really to move back up closer to home, and so really far more of a lifestyle decision. And so spoke to a couple of counties, and Stephen Rhodes, bless him, was very, very keen. So we went out and caught up with him. I'd grown up playing against Vikram Solanki, and we managed to play a year of sort of under-19s cricket together at Staffordshire. And so he'd spoke to me a little bit and what do you think? And I was like, I'd absolutely love it. And it just felt right from that first meeting, really. I mean, it really helped that Vic is a close mate and someone that I value hugely. I don't think there's going to be many better people in the game, certainly in the game in England. So it just felt like such a good fit, if I'm honest. And so just absolutely love the opportunity to go there. And again, very different than Warwickshire, very different than Middlesex, who are seen as probably bigger counties, even though Middlesex is a small county. They just happen to play at Lords, really. If you're gonna try and put, you know, a value on it in terms of big counties and small counties. But to go to Worcester, which had this incredible family feel, you know, all the boys, you know, I lived in Birmingham and still do, so I still do that commute, but they all lived within walking distance of the ground. They're incredibly tight-knit bunch, and that remains even now, and whoever it is, and it just felt like such a good fit. I couldn't have felt more comfortable there. I couldn't have felt more secure there, I guess. And for me, in those last 4 years, I thrived under that, I think.
Well, you certainly did, and just one season in particular, I couldn't have yourself on the podcast, Alan, without talking about it, and that is 2011 in the County Championship. This is absolutely staggering, and before we talk about the season, let me just read out some stats, okay? Leading wicket taker in Division 1 with 73 wickets at 24.42. And as if that wasn't impressive enough, this is amazing. You bowled 663.1 overs. 663.1 as a seam bowler. It was the second most in the entire division, behind only Monty Panesar, who bowled 750.3 for Sussex. As if that wasn't impressive enough, at the time, at 36 years of age, that is a staggering amount of overs. It really is for any seam bowler. So I have to ask, 2011, how would you go about describing your experiences? How would you go about describing your performances for Worcestershire in that now much fabled County Championship season?
I bowled that many overs because we spent a long time in the field. I do remember that. I think one thing actually happened. So, like, we've talked a little bit about the odd regret, or in hindsight, would I have done this? And believe it or not, at 36, I learned how to get the ball to, invariably, I could only ever move the ball back into a batter. It was either swing or, so that movement that we talked about earlier on, it was generally back into a batter. And really good batters would just negotiate me and almost play me like an off spinner. And then I learned during the winter, and I did some work, and I started to fiddle around a little bit, that actually I could try and get the ball to either swing or seam away. And I worked hard on that. And as the season got into it, I became more confident, and I suddenly could attack both edges. So in terms of an outcome thing, at 36, I learned a new trick, and I absolutely loved it. And that helped my bowling massively. And it made batters think again about how they were going to play me. Physically, for a 36-year-old, I was in good shape. I got looked after really well. When I first arrived at Worcester, the physio was Ben Langley, who is now the lead physio at England. Incredibly knowledgeable man, incredibly passionate, had a great way about him. And he really drove me alongside Ross Dewar, who's the strength and conditioning coach, who's still there now. And they got me in a really good place. They treated me... They gave me a bespoke program, basically. They treated me completely as an individual, which I'd never had before. It's something that's quite, I guess, quite consistent now. But at the time, it was like, well, everyone does this and everyone does that. And so for a 36-year-old seamer, I was like, we'll try. But they developed it. And Ben Davis took over from Ben Langley. And Ben's now with BCB as another physio. And they had a great understanding of me and just put me in a position where I could bowl that amount of overs. I'm only going to take 73 wickets if I stay on the park and can bowl that many overs. And that's how I do targets at the start of the year with Bumpy, with Steve Rhodes. And he'd be like, right, what's your goal for this year? I'd be like, I need to bowl 500 overs. He's like, what about wickets? I'm like, well, if I bowl 500 overs, one, it means I'm fit enough to bowl 500 overs. Two, it means you're still picking me, which means I must be doing all right. And then if I do that, everything else will stack up. And that was... You know, it took me years to understand that. And I probably had years where I was like, I'm going to try and take 50 wickets. And I get distracted by trying to take wickets rather than the process. So learned lots throughout my time. Regrettably, some took me a lot longer than others to understand. But that was what it was like. And you put all those things together alongside a side that was incredibly competitive in terms of trying to stay in the game. So we got promoted in 2010 out of nowhere. Worcestershire had lost a huge amount of players in 2009. So Kabir Ali had left, Steve Davis had left, Gareth Batty had left, Stephen Moore had left, Simon Jones had left. So the heart of the side had been ripped out. So there's a bunch of young kids and Phil Jakes, we got promoted. In 2011, we're like, what do we do now? And we stayed in games, we competed, we had a very good overseas throughout. And we had four different ones. So we had Damien Wright to start off with, a very fine first-class bowler in Australia. And then Syed Ajmal turned up, who wasn't bad, and that helped. And then he was replaced by Saqib Al-Hassan. And then finally, we had Kemal Roach. So throughout that season, we always had an overseas player who was going to make an impact with the ball. And so I was lucky enough that I would bowl a lot with them and they would create pressure and take wickets. And I think those four between them took nearly 80 wickets, I think, or in the 70s between them, and did it brilliantly well. And obviously all in different manners as well. So without a shadow of doubt, I had a very young Jack Chantrey helping me out. I had Gareth Andrew. And we just stuck together really tight, certainly on a bowling front, and that helped me massively. So I think a few things just fell in together. The wicket at New Road would invariably help me. I had a little bit of nibble and it would help me out a little bit without it being ridiculous. And so those things all sort of just stuck in place, and I was very lucky that I stayed on the park.
You say that, but you create your own luck, don't you, in the game of cricket? And again, this is a very old adage, but you never stop learning as well. You say learning that at the age of 36, that's a good lesson. The fact is, you're never too old to learn something new, even in the game of cricket. I mean, obviously in wider life as well, that's completely apparent as well. But no, I think that's a good lesson out there for seamers and spinners as well, because spinners do tend to mature a lot later. I always say that on the podcast. I'm not going to get into that discussion right now and the research behind it. But again, just don't get disheartened. There's always time. There's always room to learn new things and improve your game.
I think that's something that I've taken into my philosophy a little bit, or certainly how I talk about as a coach. It's, you've permanently got to keep trying to drive forward as a player. And I think I certainly experienced it where I just became stubborn and I became stale and I didn't try and improve. And I'm not talking about making major changes, but continually just trying to evolve as a cricketer, continue trying to get better. And certainly during my real fallow times, my times where I wasn't very successful and I didn't enjoy it, was when I just stood still and I actively wasn't trying to get better. And also my fitness, I was probably fitter at the end of my career than I was at the start of my career. That's completely wrong, really. But I ended up, the older I got, the harder I had to work at fitness, and I quite enjoyed it. So those sort of things together just gave me a chance. So I appreciate the look comment. I think I earned that. I genuinely do, but I also needed a little bit as well. But yeah, those couple of things really set me up for that season.
Absolutely. And again, we'll talk about coaching in due course, in fact, as we go towards the last stage of the podcast. But again, you learn those things and you can now put them into practice when you're teaching the new generation, can't you? You always learn. And I think that's really important as well, to learn that lesson of driving forward, have that growth mindset. Even when you do, you know, when you do feel failure, and we all fail at times, some bigger than others, but you have to move forward. You can always improve. You can always do better. You can always be better. You can always get better. And I think that's a very, very important thing to take away from today's podcast, not just in a cricketing sense, but again, in that wider life sense as well. And as a result of those incredible performances in 2011, Richo, in 2012, you were named as one of the Wisden Cricketers of the Year, which is a massive, massive honour, to say the least. It really is. So many fantastic cricketers in the last decade, let alone throughout the course of cricket history, have won those awards. They've been named as a Wisden Cricketer of the Year. I have to ask, what were your initial reactions when you heard the news that you'd won that prestigious award?
Well, George De Bell phoned me up, because he was going to be the journalist who was going to write it up. And I just thought, I'd known George, not that well, but we crossed paths quite a bit because West Midlands, Birmingham based. So I can't swear. So, but I thought it was a complete wind up. And it took quite a while. And you sort of sit there and I had a conversation with him. He's like, right, so I'm going to come and see you. Where should we go and meet? We're going to do this. We're going to do that. But congratulations, by the way. I was like, and I just sat there for probably a good hour afterwards, just trying to get my head around exactly what had happened. Didn't speak to anyone for ages. Eventually got in touch with my wife and my family to say, I don't think it's a wind-up. I don't think George would do this to me. This has actually happened. And so then from then on, it was, yeah, it sort of was, it's never really quite sunk in, if I'm honest. It's, you know, I won a couple of things during my time as a team, so county championship and things like that. And as a coach, I've been lucky enough to win a few things, but I didn't get many individual honours. So to get that, which is huge, it's pride of place. It's always there. I've got the other winners of that year to sign my one copy that I get. And just looking at those, you know, you get Alistair Cook, Kumar Sangakkara, Tim Bresnan, Glenn Chappell, all stellar names in their own way. So for me to be alongside that is, you know, I feel very fortunate.
Can I just say that's a fantastic story as well. So you still have that copy and it's signed by all of the recipients?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. That is incredible.
It's a huge honour. It's something that I'd never really thought of. And then when you get it and to go to the, you know, I had my interview with George and then you go down and you have the meal in the long room at Lord's and I sat on a table with Michael Atherton and that was to cook it. Something that I'll never forget. I'm getting goosebumps now talking about it. So to have had that opportunity to get the recognition, you know, I love Lawrence Booth who decided it was his first year. He's going to be my favourite journalist forever for doing that. And so, yeah, to get that recognition for that year was just it was amazing, really. So, you know, we managed to stay in Division One that year, which was for sure that's the only time we've ever done it. And so something that we should be really proud of. And so, like I said, I mentioned quite a few teammates in that, and they were certainly a huge part of helping me have such a successful season.
Absolutely, yeah. Because cricket, it's, you know, again, I'm going very cliche in today's episode, but it is a team sport played by individuals. And at certain moments, you are only as good as your fellow teammates. So again, another important lesson to learn. And I think that actually brings us nicely, Alan, onto our conversation about coaching. So our final segment of today's podcast, because you are currently the assistant head coach and bowling coach of Worcestershire County Cricket Club. You also were a bowling coach with my county of Warwickshire from 2014 to 2017, I believe. That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah.
Aha, got that from memory. But with regards to that initial transition into coaching, how did that come about in the first place? What were the initial steps that you took on that journey to becoming a cricket coach?
Well, yeah, I mean, we talked about it a little bit. I'm properly a cricket tragic from a cricket tragic family, really. So it was always something that I'd thought about. It was always something I was quite interested in. So I did my level one, the equivalent of level one and level two. So you imagine this a long time ago when I was 18 and 19. So I did those really early on in my time. And then we'd continually try and do a bit of coaching. I was fortunate enough that I went to South Africa through cricket a couple of times and was a coach there and sort of kept dipping my toe. Didn't know what I wanted to do, actually, after the game. Really enjoyed my coaching, but I was like, I want to try other things. So went and did some work experience at paper, sport agent, actually a spread betting company as well and things like that, and just wanted to dabble in. But coaching was always the one that I thought I'd really like to do, but I wanted to just branch out a little bit. And then I did my level three towards my end of my time at Middlesex with Chris Silverwood, actually, who's not ended up being a bad coach by the looks of it. And then I started my level four during my last year as a player at Worcestershire. And it was during that time that Graham Welsh left Warwickshire and went to Derbyshire. So it became an opportunity there. And Dougie Brown was the head of cricket at the time at Warwickshire. And he'd always, you know, we'd played a lot together, me and Doug. So we'd always kept in touch. And whenever Warwickshire played Worcester, when I was playing, we'd have a few chats. And he's like, what are you thinking of doing? I'm like, I think coaching by the end of it. I was working at Shrewsbury School in the winters as a sports coach. So doing football and cricket and other things. So I think that's where I want to go. And then when that happened, I got a phone call. I was like, would you like to apply for it? We'd love you to come in and have a chat with the chief exec and see where we get to, see what you think. And went in, not expecting too much, really. And then within a couple of days was offered the role. And so then that became a huge decision. I'd still got a year left. I was still planning on playing. But then this opportunity to go to Warwickshire as a coach. And I think I'd be amazed if there's many cricketers out there who do not worry and have those thoughts about the transition from player to not playing and what that looks like. And it had always been on my mind. And to get that opportunity, it was incredibly difficult to finish at Worcester. It was by far the hardest decision I've ever had to make. It was incredibly difficult, but it was one that I felt like I really needed to do. And so that's how that opportunity came up. And suddenly, you know, here I am. And we talked about it a bit when I was a player, a little bit out of my depth to start off with, if I'm honest. Suddenly surrounded by some very good players. You know, my first in my first couple of days of the job, I was sat down with Andy Flower talking about Boyd Rankin's Ashes series. I'm like, oh my word, right, where do I go from here? So that was how that came about. Forever grateful for Doug and the club to give me that opportunity. And we had some really good times. I really enjoyed it. I learned so much. Still very young coach, but at that stage, I was incredibly green at that level. So, yeah, I absolutely loved it. But that's how it came about. And so just to have that real tough decision in terms of leaving Worcestershire, but going on to doing something completely different. I wouldn't have left Worcestershire to play anywhere else. That is a fact.
Well, that's nice for the Worcestershire fans out there as well. That's nice for them to hear that. And
I don't think they were massively appreciative at the time.
Yeah, granted. Yeah, I can see that. I can definitely see that, considering the rivalry here in the Midlands. It's not a ridiculously fierce one, though. You know, compared to like Yorkshire, Lancashire, it only seems to flare up on Derby Day. But yeah, we don't, to be fair, it's not often that you do see players making that switch. Ed Pollock has made it this season, though, hasn't he? I suppose, ahead of 2022. But yeah, we'll have to wait and see how that pans out. Hopefully not too many runs scored against us at Edgbaston next season when Ed does make his return.
Yeah, he's going to absolutely smash it as well. I'm really confident of that. So it's good. It feels like a really good fit for Ed. He was on our academy and I coached him at Shrewsbury School. And I think he's loved his time there. I don't want to speak on his behalf, but I'm hoping it's going to be a really good fit for him and an opportunity for him to come home. So, but there has been some players, Norman Gifford, probably one of the more high profile, and we play for the Norman Gifford Trophy in the T20. So there has been some that have done it.
That is true. And Alan, just for the listeners out there, if you don't mind, just reminding them, where is the Norman Gifford Trophy in 2021?
Yeah, that's a tough one, that. I refuse to answer that question. You can ask me most things, but we'll leave that one.
I'll answer it then. It's at its rightful home at Edgbaston. But of course, I'm going to say that as the resident Warwickshire fan here on the podcast. But getting back onto coaching, because I do take a real fascination with regards to coaching. I know I do more of the media aspects of cricket, but I think having spoken to so many cricketers, you do have a healthy respect for cricket coaches, not just in terms of the way they shape you as a cricketer, but the way in which they shape your lifestyle, your life skills, and your life lessons as well. Coaches play such an important role in a cricketer's life. And you mentioned there about almost feeling not out of place, but as I said, I suppose you were thrown in at the proverbial deep end, talking to Andy Flower about Boyd Rankin. It was a very, very good Warwickshire side again as well, that had some previous success in 2010, 2012 as well, in the CB40 in the Championship. But in those real tentative stages of your coaching career, what do you say were the biggest lessons that you learned from those early years?
I think, as would be the case for a lot of people, I wanted to try and make an impact. And it's almost like I had to be, if I look back on it now, I needed to just be probably a bit more confident in who I was and just almost sit back, listen and take it in, really. I mean, I'm not an overly sort of loud person who would go in and just try and take over, but I got involved in a lot and I wanted to try and do a bit of everything. And I wanted to show people that I could do the job and I wanted to show that I could make an impact. And I think probably just that was through lack of confidence, really. That's, you know, from going from being a player who's got a lot of experience about how to coach myself and I knew exactly what I was doing in my game to then suddenly being a county, a first-class county where suddenly I'm part of, you know, the structure and part of the support network for all of these players who I did not know. You know, I barely knew any of them. I knew Jim Trouton from my time in Ian Westwood, but they're batters. They don't want to speak to me. So suddenly I had all these guys and I'm just like, I think the big lesson for me really was, considering where I was, I just needed to be confident enough to sit and listen even more and just try and just let those things evolve through longer periods. And I think I just wanted to get involved a bit too much. And I probably just ended up getting myself in a bit of a tizz. I mean, I absolutely loved it. And they looked after me brilliantly well. I mean, if you've got a bowling attack of Chris Wright, Keith Barker, Jeet Patel, Ricky Clark and Boyd Rankin, you know, you're not going to go too far wrong. I'd very much let them guys get on with it. So we enjoyed some success, I think. You know, we did in my 4 years there, we T20 finals, 3 years. The 50 over comp, won one, lost one. finished second in the championship. So I was really lucky to be surrounded by so many good people and some very, very fine players.
Oh, absolutely. Again, we spoke earlier about the Warwickshire side of the mid-90s. I'll tell you what, the Warwickshire side from 2010 to 2016, unbelievable. We've actually been lucky enough here on the podcast to have the likes of Ricky Clark on, Jeetan on, Jim Troughton as well, the captain from the 2012 season. A staggering Warwickshire side. Really, really was, and full of incredible, incredible players. And it was a very, very good time for the club. And success brings me nicely, actually, onto, I suppose, another retrospective question, Alan. And that is, from your coaching career to date, what do you say from a coach's perspective has been your highlight? Would it be a trophy? Would it be an individual success story? What would you say has been your highlight from your time in county coaching to date?
I'm going to split it up into two things, really. I think having an impact on an individual, no matter how big or small on that, those terms. So I think, you know, when I was at Warwickshire, you know, we talked about those five big players, and I don't think my impact on them would have been very big at all. But certainly the guys underneath that, I'd like to think that I've played a little bit of a part of that. So even if it was, you know, someone like Ollie, who we talked about earlier, Ollie ended up getting in a Lions squad during my time there. So did Josh Poisden. And, you know, I feel like I would have had some kind of impact on helping them get towards those things. At Worcestershire, watching Pat Brown get picked for England within a couple of years, I don't think, you know, my impact again would have been probably quite small, but it was still part of there. So I would always feel I'm never going to claim credit for anyone's success, because I think as a coach, you're kidding yourself if you think that you're the reason that's where that, you know, they've got somewhere because of you. But you take a great deal of pride that you're part of that journey, no matter how big or small. Would be the big one for me in terms of helping individuals and watching them, you know, along the way, try and achieve their dreams, knowing that, you know, not everyone is going to, but trying to help them be as good a cricketer or as good a person as you can be. And then this one will disappoint you, but without a shadow of a doubt, as a coach, it will be the T20 finals day in 2018. First time Worcestershire had ever even got to a finals day, and then to win it with, you know, I'd look at that, and we take great pride in the fact we produce our own cricketers. So within that competition, a high percentage of the lads who played in that competition for a long period of time were Worcestershire boys, had been on the academy, had gone through so much with Stephen Rhodes and Matt Mason and Damien D'Oliveira beforehand. To watch that and just be, again, a small part of that was amazing, really. And yeah, that was the one that I look back on it now. We've got it on the old Skybox, and we watch that every now and again. Incredibly proud of that day. They are absolutely magnificent days. You know, I still am a cricket purist, and the Red Bull game as a player was the one that, you know, I really enjoyed, and I really enjoy the Red Bull as a coach. But to win a one-day trophy and to win the T20 was absolutely massive.
Oh, yeah. And again, I'm not ridiculously partisan. Okay, I'm not going to come out here and say, oh, I didn't like watching Worcestershire win. Worcestershire deserved to. And I must admit, Ben Cox on that night, brilliant, wasn't he? The way in which he dispatched an excellent Sussex attack with the likes of Chris Jordan, Jofra Archer, Danny Briggs, to name but a few. It was an astonishing night and a very, very proud night as well for Worcestershire County Cricket Club, and one which I have no doubt will live long in the memory of all those Worcestershire fans who were there at Edgbaston on the night, and for those who watched it as well. A massive, massive moment for the club. And to be fair to Worcester, they have had it better than us recently in the T20 Blast. They've won it more recently. 2019 as well, very unlucky in that final. Simon Harmer at the end, incredible, incredible. The amount of class that he showed at the death against Wayne Parnell and that lovely shot at the end to secure the title for the Eagles. Worcestershire have been going in the right direction in C20 cricket. So, no, I'm always going to give credit where credit's due. And Worcestershire, in that regard, deserve plenty, because it was a very, very memorable night. And just before we get on to our concluding segment, Alan, I just want to, you know, take it back ever so slightly, because you mentioned there about individuals not always achieving their dreams. And that is part and parcel of the sport. It's one of the most hardest lessons that you'll ever learn as a coach, because you might really like a player. There may be a fantastic player. You think they've got a really high ceiling, and then something like an injury derails it. Look at Harvey Hussain, for example, at Derbyshire right now, 25 years of age, has had to retire as a result of concussion issues. I have to ask, what do you think is the toughest aspect of coaching in the world of cricket? What is the real tough aspect of the profession?
I think you've pretty much hit the nail on the head there. You know, it's a great sport to be involved with, and I absolutely love it, and so fortunate to be part of it now as a support staff. But those conversations with players where their dream or their journey, certainly with you, has ended, has been by far the toughest. So, you know, at the end of every year, it doesn't always happen, but you may lose a player. You know, they're either going to fall out of the game at professional level, or they're going to, or whatever they might want to do. And just to have that conversation with them, I find that incredibly, incredibly tough. And I've had a few of those now, and they're never going to get any easier. I know that for a fact. And so I think that's the one for me. You realise that, you know, they've put in so much work. It's the thing that's probably kept them going. It's the thing that they've always dreamt about, whatever they want to achieve. And, you know, you speak 9 out of 10 cricketers just say, I want to play for England. And then suddenly you're saying, well, actually, you're not even going to be playing county cricket for us next year. You're not going to be part of the county staff. That's an incredibly hard message. You obviously don't send it in that way, but to give them that message is incredibly difficult.
It is, yeah. And I think, again, you've absolutely nailed it there. It never gets easier, does it? It's the same with retirements. The fact is, it is part and parcel of the game. It's part of professional sport. As much as cricket, I do think I think it's not as cutthroat as, let's say, football or some of the American sports, basketball and American football, just to name two. But, I mean, it is always difficult. It's always difficult to say goodbye to players, in particular ones who have given you really good memories as well, or, again, have just been a credit to the club. One of the hardest ones for me, I mean, recently was Tim Ambrose. Obviously, Ian Bell for me. Ian Bell's my all-time cricketing idol. I'll never have a bad word to say about Ian Bell. Same with Jeetan Patel, Jonathan Trott, but Tim Ambrose really was a credit to Warwickshire County Cricket Club. And to watch him bow out of the game, I haven't really spoken about this on the podcast, but that was hard. He was our keeper for years. He was absolutely fantastic, always had time for the fans, and again, was just a real asset to the club. And he bowed out of the game in front of no fans. I thought it was really, really quite sad to see that, to be honest. And again, with young cricketers, this is a bit of a stat which I don't think many people actually quite appreciate, but the average county career lasts between 2 and 3 years. If you go in there as a young cricketer, because so many cricketers nowadays get 6 to 12 month contracts and don't make it. That's just, you know, it's the nature of the beast. To see the likes of a Darren Stevens be here for over 20 years is extraordinary. And again, he deserves all the plaudits that he can, but the majority of cricketers are not going to make it at county level, let alone, as you said, the international level beyond that. And even those who toil away for years in the county circuit, look at the likes of Glenn Chappell, look at the likes of Chris Rushworth, look at the likes of James Hildreth, look at the likes of Darren Stevens. These guys have never played international cricket, and yet they've toiled away for years. It's immensely, immensely hard having those conversations and seeing dreams, unfortunately, you know, come apart. But it is part of the game. It's a sad part of the game. And yeah, you just have to learn to live with it, I suppose. And that's quite good advice, I think, for young coaches.
It's part of the game. You're right. It's nowhere near as ruthless as some other sports, and certainly not football, where it's a ridiculous stat of, you know, cads coming through the academy, players coming through the academy, it's 0.something% of a chance of actually making it. It's ridiculous. It's not quite that, but it is becoming more ruthless. You know, people are moving more. There's far more interaction between counties. Players are moving around a lot more. And I think in respect to that, counties are making decisions on players a lot earlier as well. You know, when I first started, the Derbyshire second 11, and then even when I got to Warwickshire, the Warwickshire was full of guys in their mid-20s who'd been on the staff for 5-6 years. And you don't get that much now. It's almost like a 21, 22. Well, if they've not improved, if they've not done that, then we'll move on to the next ones. And it's becoming far more like that. And that is incredibly tough. I have a huge passion, but I need to do so much more work on talent ID, and I'm really interested in it. But how do you, you know, where does that come from? And when do you start making decisions on players, and how do you make more informed decisions on players? It becomes incredibly difficult. And I have no doubt that, you know, there'll be a large amount of players who the decision was made too early on them. And you never know. And so it's you know, accepting that as a coach and understanding that, it's incredibly difficult. You know, there's that. And you even talked about guys who retire. Very few players retire on their terms. Very few players get the opportunity to, you know, bow out in front of their home crowd when they've wanted to. And so I think you have to get your head around that as a professional sportsman, that it's, you know, cricket more so than ever is a game of failing. And so that will be part of it, that you might not make it or you might not get the end that you want. It's something that's out of your control. You have to just crack on with it and not let it affect you.
You do indeed. You do indeed, Alan. And again, I keep on saying good advice, but honestly, listeners, just listen to this. It really is. I'm learning a lot from this podcast because it is part and parcel of the game. But again, you have to learn with failure, don't you? That's another lesson to take away from today's podcast. In particular for batsmen, I'm a bowler. Don't get me wrong. My batting average is like 11 in village cricket. Don't ever come to me for batting advice. My go-to shot is the outside edge or the inside edge if I'm lucky. Okay, it's not exactly the crispy and bell cover drive, but you are going to fail more times than you succeed. You're going to have more ducks. You're going to get out for less than 10 far more times than you ever get a century. But the key thing to learn for young cricketers out there, young boys, young girls as well, is that your failures do not define you. When we look at the greats of the game, the Tendulkars, the Dravids, the Pontings, the Sir Alistair Cooks, the modern greats, Joe Root, Kohli, Azam, Williamson, Smith, what do we remember them for? Remember them for the incredible knocks in the World Cup or in an Ashes series or in a bilateral series. We don't remember them for the Golden Ducks or the dodgy LBWs or the poor shots. Remember them because of the excellent things that they achieved. And that's something really important, again, to take away from today's podcast. So, Richo, before we end, just one final question for the budding coaches out there. I suppose I have to ask, what advice would you give to any young up-and-coming coaches in the world of cricket? What advice could you give them to set them on the right pathway into this profession?
I think it would be, I talked about it a little bit in my playing, it's continually try and drive forward. So for me, as a young coach, I wish I'd done more reading. I wish I'd put myself out there and done more coaching in different situations and gone and spoke to different people. And I think for me, in terms of how you're going to keep getting better, will be that's a big reason why coaches will get better, to put themselves in those situations, to put them, give themselves exposure at things, take themselves slightly out of the comfort zone. We talk about it to players all the time. You know, you're going to have to do this. You're going to take yourself out of your comfort zone. Well, as a coach, you need to be able to do that as well. And if you're not willing to do that, you can't ask your players to do that. And so I think that was a big one for me. And then just be yourself. There are going to be times where you have to treat people differently, from whether it be an age group player to a senior professional, that you know, you go from being sort of a teacher to a mentor and all the things that go in between that. So your style might change a little bit, but actually your personality and the way that you treat people should be really consistent, I think. And just try and coach your way, the way that you are. And if you are that person who's, you know, can be quite reflective and quite quiet and not say too much, then don't worry about that too much. If you get that right, you will smash it. If you're going to be the guy who's quite loud and in your face, then do it. But you're going to do it because it's you, and you are all about helping the person that's in front of you.
100%. We've heard that so many times on the podcast. It is a common theme. And again, it's one for any young coaches out there. Be yourself. There isn't a better piece of advice, to be honest. And again, tailoring to individual needs as well. You can't have a one-size-fits-all policy, can you, when it comes to coaching? Because there are different individuals. Some are going to need that arm around them. Some are going to need that a little bit more stern approach. There's not a one-size-fits-all. You have to be adaptable. You have to be flexible. But most importantly, be yourself. Carve out your own identity. And that is some fantastic advice for any budding young coaches out there. So, Alan, before we say our goodbyes, we do just have one final fan question. Instead of doing them as one concluding segment, I have actually put them throughout the podcast today. But I suppose it's not really a fan question, because a certain Paul Franks from Nottinghamshire, Paul has said, how does it feel to be the second best batsman in your house?
I'm going to take that as a bit of a compliment. There's four in the house at the moment, and my son Harry, who's six, is by far a better batter than me already. So I'd take that as a compliment because I'd love to bat like Harry, even now or as a pro. And then my daughter and my wife, who've never played the game, they're probably better batters than me as well. So if he thinks I'm the second best batter in the house, I will take that as a compliment. Yeah, it is tough. And I'm there frequently throwing him balls, but refusing to coach him and letting him crack on with it, and intrigued to see how he'll go if he continues to be in love with the game as much as he is at the moment.
Exactly. That's important at this stage. It's not to go, you know, too ridiculously overboard and start coaching and going for fundamentals. It's about enjoyment, isn't it? At that stage, it's about getting into the game, you know, getting the love of cricket, getting that fire burning inside, shall we say, when it comes to this wonderful game. And Paul, all I'll say, decent question that. I must admit, I think that's a nice way to end the podcast, to be honest, with a question straight from the Jimmy Ormond Book of Sledges. I think that's a wonderful way to wrap up today's podcast. So, Alan, before we say our goodbyes, do you just have anything to plug or promote? Any social media channels, websites, anything along those lines?
No, we're all good.
Well, in that case, Alan, all that's left for me to say is thank you very much for coming onto the podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've learned so much from talking to you from the past hour and 20 minutes, I believe, or an hour and a half. Apologies for keeping you for this long, Alan. Time has just flown by.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, that is my pleasure. We always like to hear that here on the podcast. But to all of our wonderful listeners out there, thank you very much for tuning in. And as always, guys, we'll see you on the next one.